Selection Committee, I welcome you with open arms.
Is that so? How late do you stay open?
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
What's up, everybody? You're listening to NoCo Cinema here on WGN Plus, your guide to cinema here in the city of Chicago. I am Tom Hush, and got a very special couple of episodes coming to you this week, starting with this one right here. I had the absolute pleasure of heading up to Glens Falls, New York for the Adirondack Film Festival, which is a spectacular film festival programmed by the great Jess Lewandowski, who you may remember from Middle Coast Fest. She's been on the show before, and she's an incredible film programmer who programs festivals all across the country. And she was kind enough to invite me to head up to Glens Falls, a little bit north of Albany, about an hour north of Albany, New York, and check out what they had to offer. And let me tell you, it was a fantastic experience, an amazing few days of film and conversation. I was really pleased to be there, and just a huge thank you to Jess and the whole festival and everybody who was there. One of the things that I thought was really remarkable about it was the number of filmmakers who actually were in attendance. When it comes to film fests, often filmmakers can't necessarily make it to every fest that they've submitted to. Obviously, there's a lot of financial stuff involved with that, and plus just time alone. You can't go to every festival that you submit to, but you want to get a huge reach. But the Adirondack Film Festival was able to get literally hundreds of filmmakers there who were showing their stuff, and it was really a pleasure to get to listen to them talk about their films and be able to have awesome conversations with them afterwards, especially because there were specifically not a whole lot. I don't think there were any Q&As, or at least I did not see any specific Q&As before or following the films, which I thought was an awesome choice. It really pushed the community aspect of the Adirondack Film Festival. It took away some of the unnecessary formality that film festivals sometimes have, and it was more encouragement to just, you know, talk to the filmmakers outside of the film and have a very just normal conversation about cinema and all that kind of stuff. Each filmmaker, if they were in attendance, would go up prior to the screening of their short or of their feature and say, hey, this is who I am, this is my film, and you can meet me at this bar or this restaurant or whatever. And you could just strike up a conversation with them. And I thought that was an excellent choice on the part of the festival. So, without further ado, we've got three interviews for this first sort of episode of coverage of the Adirondack Film Festival. There were so many people that I was lucky enough to talk to, and there's going to be a ton more interviews coming your way. So we're going to do this in kind of capsules of interviews, different stuff from different people. So first, you're going to hear from Greg Emmetaw and Melissa Roth, who are from a film called Camp Wedding, which is a kind of horror comedy that riffs on 80s slashers and that sort of thing. Tries to turn the whole thing a little bit on its head, and it's a really fun watch. And that's even something that you can watch on Amazon right now. You can rent it if you want to check it out following our conversation. Then there is Ken Holmes, who is one of the directors of a experimental short called Old Hearts Cafe. We talk a little bit about his improvisational approach to the film and how he kind of balances the two parts of himself that are both kind of wild and free and want to do everything in the moment, and also the very type A planning part of himself and how that all factored into Old Hearts Cafe. And then finally, really, really awesome conversation with one of Chicago's very own, Lane Marie Williams, and her team from Veiled Tractate, which is an experimental short that her and all these amazing people got together and shot here in Chicago. Takes place mostly in Chinatown, very non-narrative, and it's something to behold. And if you're here in the city, if you're following the film scene at all, Lane Marie is definitely on your radar. So that conversation, the very last conversation, will be with a whole group of people that worked on Veiled Tractate. So obviously we'll have director Lane Marie Williams, producer Amy Powell. Of course, we have to have editor Anna Christian. And then rounding it out, we also have Kate Rappel, who did all the sound and a lot of the soundtrack. So it's a whole crew of people. And you get every facet of how this short came together, which is something that you don't get to hear a lot or see a lot. So without further ado, here is our coverage from the Adirondack Film Festival in Glens Falls, New York. Kicking off our coverage here at the Adirondack Film Festival in Glens Falls, New York, I've got two people from the film Camp Wedding. Very excited to introduce here Greg Emmetaw and also Melissa Roth. Greg is the writer-director of the picture, and Melissa is in the film as Alexis, but also pulls double duty as the main makeup artist. So let's jump right into it. This is something that is near and dear to my heart, weddings and horror. I think this is a great put together of two things that I think are really fun and I don't think I've seen in a film before. Greg, you're the writer-director. Tell us a little bit about how the idea came together. When did you decide, I want to do a horror movie that is also a wedding story?
It's kind of actually really long story, but probably the simplest thing was that I wanted to revisit some kind of like horror, thriller, supernatural kind of project. A long time ago, I made a film called Neat Freak, which was about like a kind of like a obsessive compulsive poltergeist that instead of like causing disorder, imposed order. And that was really the first film I made with my roommates. We just all shot it in this apartment over a weekend. We shot like 45 pages in a weekend. It was insane. I don't know what I was thinking, you know, but I learned a lot from that. And that was like back in like 2002. And I wanted to kind of revisit that. And my good friend who was in that movie, Car Consilvio, who's the co-story writer and the executive producer of this, she was like, we should revisit that project, you know? And we originally, like about 10 years ago, we were thinking, oh, there's this cabin in the woods that our family owns that's supposedly haunted. And we're like, oh, that might be interesting. But then they had to sell it, you know? And then she had a wedding at a summer camp. And I was like, oh, maybe this is the way we find our way into it. And so what's funny is like I had not actually seen Friday the 13th at that point. Mm-hmm. So I much like after writing the first draft of the script, I was like, oh, this whole summer camp horror is kind of a thing, you know, and that hadn't occurred to me. And so eventually we sort of realized that it was kind of a tropey thing. And there's some references to that in the film.
Sure.
But that is where it came from. And it was really based more on her wedding than this history of summer camps being, you know, places for bloodbaths.
Yeah, it's a weird kind of cultural thing. Most people, even if they've never seen Friday the 13th, they're just kind of idea that like, yeah, out in the woods, somewhere we've never been before, isolated, murder. Why not? Why not? So the setup to this is really interesting. They Airbnb a wedding for at a camp, and things just kind of go worse from there. You mentioned that you engage with some of the tropes. When you realize that this was going to be something that would call back to a little bit of the heyday of the slashers, even unintentionally, how did you want to write those tropes in while still making them fun and a good time for the audience overall?
Well, one thing that I always love in movies is kind of, especially horror movies, is kind of a really elaborate, crazy backstory that gets unearthed. Like, that's my favorite thing in a horror is when it's like, wait, but as a friend of mine says, she's like, all of your projects have but 200 years ago, little did they know, you know? And so I was like, okay, let's just go crazy with that. So like this camp, not only like you see this in the very beginning of the film, but like you realize the camp was the site of like a Native American massacre. It was also the site of some witch burnings later in time. And then we also learned that like some camper drowned in the 80s after being struck by lightning, and that shut the camp down. So the camp is, I mean, we, you know, the camp kind of is like trapped in the 80s, which mm-hmm. is also, I love that kind of period and the electronics from that period. So I wanted to have this connection to all that. And so to me, there's also this sense of those summer camp movies being an 80s thing, mm-hmm. you know, so all of that felt like that was a way to approach that. Also, we didn't have the kind of budget to like make the entire film in the 80s.
Right.
So this was a way to kind of have like a nod to that without going that way. Also, I wanted to explore social media and cell phones, which are a big part of the movie actually as well. So that's where the Airbnb aspect of it, I guess, comes in, because there's a lot of like the characters just not really connecting. They're all connected to the world that they've left, but they're sort of forced together in this place. And the idea in a way is like, they have to communicate to survive in this world. So whereas usually losing cell service is a way to like make people helpless, in this case, the cell service is what's making them helpless.
A nice turn on turning it on its head. And if I do say so myself, the 80s are very in right now. They are the subject of most people talk about Stranger Things. That sort of stuff is really hot. And I was curious, why do you think that the 80s have been such a gold mine of filmmaking and television right now? Because you've got stuff like Stranger Things, American Horror Story is doing its own riff on the 80s slasher, and while it was more or less unintentional that you waded into this territory, what is it about the 80s that interests you from an aesthetic sort of place? The soundtrack as well seems very like a little synth heavy, very 80s. So what got you excited about that aspect?
I mean, I have for a long time like decided that like 1985 was some sort of pinnacle of cinema, because I guess some of my favorite movies are like The Goonies, Return to Oz, Back to the Future. All these movies came out in that year. It's crazy. And there's several others that you're like Witness, like all these amazing films. And I think maybe it's just, it's like a time of, I think part of it is that we feel so surveilled, and kids seem so surveilled now, mm-hmm. whereas like all those movies, like Goonies, could never happen today because the kids would never be allowed out of the house without supervision, you know, like, and I don't know, I think that's part of it, is that we don't feel like we can go on those kinds of adventures anymore, and we're always connected to the outside world, and those stories are mostly about both kids kind of escaping their real world to some fantasy place, mm-hmm. and saving parents, which now with these parents that are constantly like pre-saving children at all times, not that I'm saying that, you know, parents should just let kids go anywhere,
right.
but like I think part of the magic of those stories was the kids were empowered to save the parents, and you don't see that as much anymore, or it seems like that's further away, or it's a harder thing to imagine, and maybe we're all remembering that. And I think also the people that grew up in the 80s are now like a big market, you know.
True.
They're all professionals, you know. So it's sort of serving them. But I'd love to hear what you think of that. Melissa is really the horror expert here.
I don't know.
All right. Expert, well, I mean, Melissa, you're both in the movie. You play Alexis, mm-hmm. and you said that you worked on the makeup and everything.
As well, yeah.
And that's so integral to horror. That my favorite horror is very makeup heavy. Mm-hmm. For me, I think the 80s was pretty much the peak of horror cinema in terms of going completely, pardon the expression, balls out. I mean, I for a period of time watched John Carpenter's The Thing every single week for like 2 or 3 months, because I was blown away by what Rob Bottin was doing and how much it made me more involved in the movie, knowing that this was real to a certain extent. So both as a makeup person, as a makeup artist, how did you approach?
Well, this one, we did want to keep things kind of simple. So a lot of the effects are really just, you know, practical makeup, shading, that kind of thing. We use contacts as a big one to set off when the switch happens in people. And we, so we use contacts, we use lighting. So it's a lot more practical effects, instead of digitally,
changing things
and working things out, which I think work better. And again, I think that goes back to why things from the 80s now are kind of making a comeback. You know, we went so far in technology and the digital age that I think people want a little bit of a step back so they can relate to it a little bit more, you know.
people want like squibs. They want.
Well, I think they want squibs and they want blood effects. They want something that they can react to viscerally, as opposed to technology kind of taking hold and saying, "This is what you're seeing."
You know? While it is easier to a certain extent, there's no cleanup. You simply go on the back end, and you're just like, "All right, we're gonna have blood splatter here, blood splatter here." Even one of my favorite movies of the year so far, John Wick Chapter 3. It uses digital blood effects. Now, that's for practicality purposes, with that many bodies piling up in a short period of time. But it loses, as you said, a little bit of that visceral nature, as when watching something from the 80s where it's like, I think it was the original Friday the 13th when Kevin Bacon gets an arrow through the neck, and it's literally Tom Savini's assistant pumping blood with his mouth, and it's gurgling. It's horrible. I really appreciate that you're taking this approach with something that does call back and all that kind of stuff. Greg mentioned that you are the horror expert. How true is that?
I mean, I've been a fan since I was a kid. Reading horror books, watching horror movies, all of that. I specialize special effects makeup, so prosthetics and sculpting and, you know, the blood effects, all of that. Monsters. And,
yes.
You know.
All the fun stuff. All the really fun stuff.
Yeah. Get your hands dirty and, you know.
There's something really nice about that. That you get to have a craft. Because, again, I don't want to disparage digital artists. They go through, as you know, tons of training and tons of artistry just to do it. But I'm sure on some level, even they kind of want to maybe get in the clay, get in a little bit of the prosthetics.
And there often is, too. There is sculpting. Even if it's digital, you still, you know, you have these programs where you really get to 3D sculpt. And, you know, and also now with the 3D printing, you know, it kind of marries the two, I think. You can digitally create something, but then you can, you know, practically make it.
Yeah.
So
how did it feel pulling double duty here? You have to be in the film and also work on everybody's, you know, prosthetics and effects.
I brought in another makeup artist to help with that, so I wasn't doing everything by myself, which was helpful. You know, always have a team of people that you can call on when you have to kind of bounce around, wear different hats.
Absolutely. Yeah. So is this your guys' first time at the film festival? Have you been to Adirondack before?
I haven't, actually. I don't even know quite how we found out about this, but it's been a really great experience already. We were just at their opening last night, and to me, like, part of the measure of a film festival is, like, other than, like, how great the website looks, which obviously matters so much now, you're like oh, these are some good font choices, that's awesome. You know, but do people show up, you know, to the screenings? And last night was completely packed, and it was such a great group, and there's something like 300 of the filmmakers here, which is unreal.
Yeah, I cannot believe it. I arrived last night. This is my first full day so far. I haven't even had the chance to see anything, and yet the whole town is crawling with people going to the festival, people who have films in it, and just fans all around. This is pretty remarkable. Is this the first film festival that Camp Wedding has been shown at, or have you guys been making the rounds?
We've been making the rounds. Like, this is maybe the 14th or something, actually.
Oh my gosh.
We just had three in a row in New York City, so we're having kind of our New York month. It's crazy.
Well, so it's a tiring process based on, I've talked to other filmmakers, and it's not only you want to be there, you don't want to just submit and be like, whatever, maybe people will like it. You want to see the reaction, but it can be costly. There's travel, there's the submission fees and all that kind of stuff. Have you been handling it pretty well? Has it been a bit of a stressor?
Well, I mean, it's like we can't make it, like, not all of us can make every festival, but like different people have been able to make different ones, which has been great. You know, like Cliff Miller, who plays Jack in the movie, happens to now live in Texas, so he was able to go to the screening we had in Waco.
Excellent.
You know, and Cara, the executive producer, co-star writer, I was out of town for an opera. This is my other life. That's what I do for money. It's bizarre. And so she went to this great festival, Jim Thorpe in Pennsylvania, and said it was fantastic. So it's great to have everyone be able to go to kind of different festivals as it tours around. But yeah, you have to kind of weigh, I guess, whether or not it's worth it to go. But this one really looked great, and just the outreach from the festival was really good, and that always, absolutely, you know, and they're like, and they put us up at a hotel, which we kind of think is maybe haunted, and we're taking tons of photos. We're like, how can we shoot at this amazing hotel?
That'll be for later. That'll be for a different wedding-based horror movie.
Exactly.
When it comes to camp wedding, I'll have both of you give an answer. What was the most satisfying part of making this movie? What did you enjoy the most?
Oh, wow. I mean, I really loved the whole process of, like, from the first idea through, like, the first real public screening. It's hard to, like, pick one. But, I mean, I think the most satisfying thing on this was probably our last day of shooting, because it was such an intense... We shot for 13 days. We had, like, about one day off within that, which for, you know... And this was a script that... At least the original script was, like, 100 pages. So that's... It was intense.
Absolutely.
As I'm sure you can attest to, Melissa. And it was mostly at night. You know, we had, like, 3 days that were actually during the day. The rest of it was all-night shoots. We were always running out of... darkness, as opposed to running out of daylight, which is usually the issue. We were running out of darkness. So the last day, I think it was like a 16-hour crazy. We had to, like, end it in the freezer. There's a lot of scenes in the freezer. So, and at that point, it was just, like, such an amazing relief. And then everyone had to, like, pack up and leave. But it was, I feel like it was just feeling like we had actually shot everything. Like, I was so afraid the whole time. And the AD was like, we're never going to make all these scenes. You have to start cutting things.
Right.
And we somehow got everything. So it's, that was amazingly satisfying, I think.
Just to get all in. Melissa, what about yourself?
There was a day we're shooting on the dock, and it's, I don't want to give anything away, but the sun rose over the dock, and it was absolutely gorgeous and beautiful, and every character was out there. Everybody after the, you know, I don't remember which day, that was towards the end, though. And it was that moment where the sun came up and we all rose from the dead, or whatever happens. And it was just the most beautiful moment. And everybody there, the entire crew was there, the entire cast was there. And it was just one of those moments of, like, togetherness, like when you're working with all of these people for so long. And, you know, it was rough. Like, I mean, the process was hard. It's outdoors. It's in the woods. It's overnight shoots. So nobody's sleeping. Nobody's got, like, you know, but everybody was focused and committed. And there was just this moment where we were all together and the sun rose upon us and glistened over the water. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful moment of feeling like you've done the thing that you set out to do. And
especially with such an intense shooting time, you know, I'm really glad that you got everything in that you wanted to get in. And I imagine your AD, like, I know how hard of a job that can be for an assistant director, be like, oh, we got to do all this. We got to do this. And not getting everything in can be terrible. I think just, there was a movie with Michael Fassbender in it, I want to say last year, called The Snowman, where they just completely missed entire parts of the plot, and just, they were like, well, we have to release it. So they released it, having missed like about a week of shooting. So you guys got down there, worked hard, and you got to go to camp with a great group of people. I did see that this is available for rental on Amazon Prime. You can check it out over there. The DVD is also available for purchase. I always get curious with the time that we're living in the digital revolution, people can get pretty much any type of content anywhere they want. What did you plan? Like, yeah, we're going to do a heavy digital release and we're going to get this out there. How did it affect the post film process and getting people to actually see it?
I mean, I wish I could say that it was super strategic. I think what happened was we got approached by Gravitas, who was, like, doing our distribution in the midst of our festival run. And I think it is nice to be able to, like, be at a festival, and if people miss it, be like, oh, you can also see it online.
Sure.
You know, and it's sort of like there's still buzz associated with the festival while we're releasing it. And for me, it's like the most important thing is that it just finds an audience. Like, it's we've seen this before. Like, it's not everyone's cup of tea. Some really hardcore horror people want more gore. They want more nudity, apparently. but according to some, like, other podcasts I've heard, it's been interesting to hear all these responses. But some people, like, this is like something they haven't seen before and they really connect with it. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's nice, you know, to, I think the idea has always been like, how can we kind of cast the net as wide as possible to then have the people that really connect with this find it, you know, be able to connect with
Absolutely. It's funny you mention horror fans, because they are notoriously hard to please, because everybody's got such a different taste. Some mm-hmm. people are really into the gore stuff. Some people want more psychological, all that kind of stuff. So when you were making Camp Wedding, were you considering that, like, hey, how is this going to play to the hardcore people? How is this going to play to the casual audience who just wants a little scare? What were your thoughts on that?
I mean, it's funny because I never, like, I don't think I was considering a lot of those things. I mean, I think it's a sort of a trap to try to, like, please everyone or please certain groups of people. Like, I feel like all you can really do is please your own, like, the movie you'd want to see, mm-hmm. because inevitably then other people are going to be on board with that. So, I mean, to me, this was about making something that, to me, like, I hadn't seen before, and hopefully other people would enjoy, you know, like, reversing this trope of, like, everyone's cell phone doesn't work and now they're helpless, you know, like, what's the opposite of that? I mean, to me, the horror in this is, like, getting a confusing text message that says fine, and you don't know if that's, like, fine or fine, you know, like, you don't know what the tone is, and that's the horror of this movie, you know.
Spectacular.
So yeah, that's my thought.
All right, Camp Wedding. Greg, Melissa, thank you so much for taking the time. I'm sure you guys are busy, and I know you're leaving tonight to go head back to New York, so best of luck on the film going forward. I hope you guys get as much distribution as possible. Horror hounds, horror fans, keep your eye out for this one. Camp Wedding, Greg and Melissa, thank you both so much. Joined here now by Ken Holmes, a director, one of three directors on a comedy sci-fi short that is described as experimental. It's screening as part of the Experimental Jokes Shorts program here at the Adirondack Film Festival. Really excited to check it out. Ken, thanks so much for stepping in and having a little conversation with me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So, Ken, tell me a little bit about yourself. Where are you from, and how did you get into the world of short films?
Well, I grew up around here, actually, and I'm currently living in Brooklyn, and I'm primarily an actor, and kind of between gigs, I was kind of feeling like, you know, I'm a good writer, I should just kind of write my own pieces, write my own films. So I wrote this idea for a television series called Old Hearts Cafe, like, years ago, and it was just like a sketch comedy idea, kind of like Robot Chicken meets Allen Ginsberg or something was kind of my feeling, like, kind of like experimental beat poets, a lot of hipsters, but just all random, and I thought I would do all the characters too. And so that was my idea. But there was one character in particular who I really liked, and that is the basis for the pilot, Old Hearts Cafe. And the pilot is Marcus, The Adventures of a Dishwasher, with dreams of becoming a filmmaker. And right now it stands alone as a short film. At some point I might actually do it as a web series, though.
All right, so this is kind of a jumping off point for
exactly.
you. So in Old Hearts Cafe, this sort of pilot, Marcus makes a short film on the evils of technology. All right, so tell me a little bit about why about this character Marcus, and what's his beef with technology? Why is he so riled up?
I think his beef with technology is that a lot of people have beef with technology, and he wants to just jump in on that. He's very much living an angsty life, and he wants to make a stand against something. And he feels like technology is taking us away from just observing reality. And a lot of people feel that way. I have my own views, which you can, I don't know, I don't really want to take a stand about it. I kind of want just you to think I'm on your side, whatever side you're on.
Well, I mean, you cited the beat poets in this,
and
its experimental nature. And the beat poets, to me, also were people that questioned people's perception of reality, how they were engaging the world. They saw a sort of malaise. They saw a sort of disinterest, disengagement. While these beats wanted to get more engaged with things, be very in the moment. Mm-hmm. If we're going to get literary, talk about On the Road, which is a total just stream of consciousness. How much of that philosophy did you want to bake into Old Hearts Cafe?
I wanted quite a bit of that in there. Stream of consciousness is actually like a big part of my writing style. That's how I started writing. I used to just, even before I knew how to write, I would just like, I would narrate stories to my dad just off the top of my head and have him write them down. Or I would take a tape recorder and I would just say whatever came to my head. And I still like to write that way. Yeah. And actually for Old Hearts Cafe, the end of the movie, there's a poem. And what we did is my one of my co-directors and I, we just shot all this footage and then we just played it and I watched it and I just came up with a poem, just totally improvised it. And that last poem of the movie is just how I felt looking at the images.
Wow. That is fascinating. That is really well, because film is so constructed in many ways. Like there's a lot of setup and a lot of hurry up and wait, getting ready and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I know.
So how did your background as someone who enjoys the stream of consciousness, the in the moment, the improvisation, how did you feel working in this medium? Did it feel constrictive at all, or were you freed by this new world?
I'm freed by it. Look, I got two personalities. There's the writer-director personality, and then there's the actor personality. The actor personality is actually super OCD, likes order, likes research. And the writer side of me actually just likes to be free and is a lot more like, let's just see what happens. And I don't know. The two personalities within me kind of keep me grounded or keep me crazy. I don't know which.
Yeah. Well, the idea of having these two sides of yourself and then having to wrestle with them in the art, mm-hmm. I think that's a really fascinating thing. You have two co-directors here, Greg Boyea,
yep,
and Cameron Gallagher,
mm-hmm.
And how was it working with them? You had this vision yourself. This was your idea initially.
Yeah.
How did they get involved, and how did they help you shape where Old Hearts Cafe was going to go?
So I wrote it a few years before I met them, mm-hmm. and then I met them on a mini series that Cameron was directing, and I sort of like I felt like Cameron has a good eye, and he's much more technical than I am. And then Greg was just like a lot of fun to work with, and he helps everybody loosen up and just have fun. And I felt that we could just we could really make something together. I really like collaborating with people. I feel like somebody else's eye or perspective will help me in a way that maybe I couldn't have come up as well with on my own.
Sure.
I feel like when it's just me, like I'm definitely more, I'm very loose and collaborative, which is fine, but it makes it hard when it's just me, because mm-hmm. I like people's feedback.
Right.
And
right.
So I really like working with people, especially people who have strengths that I might not have.
It's a good idea. Have the people around you that can pick up where you know you might be lacking in a certain thing.
Exactly.
I do get annoyed by this idea of the single auteur, like, you know, mm-hmm. these single geniuses, when especially in the world of film, it's so many people involved. You've got people in various films, you know, you've got lighting, you've got makeup, you've got editing, you've got sound, all this sort of stuff. So I like this idea that you're aware of this. You know, mm-hmm. like, hey, I know this part and I know this part. Let's surround myself with people who know the rest of that, and we can make a thing together, and it can be like that. What was the vibe on set? Were they also wanting to roll with the punches, or were they helping give the shape to your kind of wild ideas?
A little bit of both. They were rolling with the punches, but they also had some great ideas that I would not have come up with. Like they saw influences that I didn't even know I was influenced by. I think Cameron mentioned that he felt like the script was like a Wes Anderson script.
Okay.
And that was not my intention at all. I wasn't like studying his films and being like, oh yeah, I want to do something like that. It just kind of like, that's an observation that he had. And in rereading the script, I realized, yeah, I guess you're right. Let's roll with that. So he was definitely instrumental in the kind of Wes Anderson vibe that the movie had. We did set up the shots. There was some structure to it, but it was on the day.
Yeah. It was how you were feeling.
It was how we were feeling. Yeah.
I like that a lot. Cause as much as I appreciate a really well set up shot, there's a lot of fun to be had in just like, all right, we're here now in the environment. Maybe you scoped it out a little bit before, but you're like, it's different now. We're on a different day. We can do something else. You mentioned that you grew up in the area, as in the area around Glens Falls or whereabouts.
I grew up in Vermont.
Okay.
Vermont, yeah.
And how much of your upbringing in Vermont had an effect on the way that you go about your art or go about your view of the world? I find that a lot of people's hometowns seep into what they want to talk about and their kind of view of the world. So growing up in Vermont, do you feel that that makes its way into Old Hearts or into your stream of consciousness world?
It doesn't. It doesn't. I mean, I guess it does in a way, because there's a sense of, especially with me being all the characters, there's kind of a sense of it just being me. And in Vermont, I definitely, certainly in comparison to where I live now in New York, there was definitely a feeling of like, all right, I wake up in the morning and it's the me show.
Yeah.
and there definitely is that. Maybe I wouldn't have come up with that if I was living in New York. Also because in New York, there's a pool of actors to choose from.
Sure.
And here there is less of that. Well, there definitely are actors, but there's always everybody has jobs outside of acting, so it's there's scheduling, and so I just thought it's easier just working with me.
Yeah, and write your own stuff, get yourself into your own things.
Maybe if I was in Brooklyn, I would just be like, I wouldn't have thought of that as much, because there's so many hungry actors who want exposure and footage for their reels. And even before I could have paid them, I can pay them now, but like even before I could have, there's so many people who just want footage and just want credits.
That's wild. That's what, because it's like, that's the payment, that will lead to the payment.
Yeah, exactly.
It's one of the few fields where you can pay people in footage.
Yeah.
So you moved over to Brooklyn straight from Vermont.
Mm-hmm.
What was behind the decision? You mentioned obviously you're acting. New York is, I mean, it's New York. What is there to say? It's a place where artistic people congregate, and there's so much to be done. Did it change your headspace in any way? Was there a little bit of culture shock getting to such a massive city?
I mean, not really, because I grew up a little bit in Manhattan, so it wasn't too much of a culture shock. I wasn't born in Vermont. I was born in New Jersey, so I'm kind of all over the place.
you're just New England in general.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you like most about New York?
I love the feeling of anything is possible. And I love all the work that there is to. There's so much work. And I'm still writing, too. I was worried that because I might not have as much free time that I wouldn't be writing. But actually, the writing is still there. In fact, all the busy schedule is almost fueling me to write even more.
Very cool. That's excellent. That's very good. So, Old Hearts Cafe, you want this to continue on. What do you already have the next few steps, next episodes or installments in Old Hearts Cafe ready to go, or just swirling around at least?
So I have a couple written, but I think I want to go in a new direction and actually incorporate some other actors into it. And I've been talking with a collaborator recently, a new collaborator, and I think we're going to do something together, and maybe, I don't want to give anything away, but I have a great, or we have a great idea of a character for her. And so, yeah,
it's all very exciting stuff. When it comes to, your film history, what you liked watching growing up or things that you found influential, you know, whether it was latent, obviously some of your collaborators mentioned Wes Anderson, were there any, filmmakers or writers that you intentionally said, I want this to look or feel like this, or even if you just want to mention filmmakers that you enjoy that you're watching.
I'm a fan of Richard Linklater. I feel like there definitely is a feeling of his films in Old Hearts Cafe and some of the stuff I've done in the past, particularly his old, well, I mean, I like all of his work, but as far as my stuff, I feel like his older work, like Waking Life, well, like Waking Life wasn't that old, but Slacker.
Yeah.
Slacker, definitely.
Slacker is one of my favorite movies of all time. I really love Slacker, and that it's that stream of consciousness you mentioned where you're just kind of like following people along. How'd you get introduced to Linklater?
I think Waking Life was my first movie that I saw of his.
Uh-huh.
And I'm fascinated by dreams. And the idea of somebody not being able to wake up was really interesting to me. That was actually a nightmare of mine as a child.
Okay.
So to see somebody doing a movie about something that was a phobia or a fear of mine, and I didn't realize that other people had that idea.
Yeah.
So it was interesting. Like, that's one of the things I love about art in general, is to see somebody taking something that you thought of and getting to it first. I actually don't hate that, because I feel like there are a lot of ideas in the world. I almost find it comforting when I see an artist take something. It's like, oh yeah, I thought of that.
Yeah, that's one way that they can do it. And it doesn't preclude you from taking your own perspective on that same thing.
Right.
Such a diverse world. Again, Old Hearts Cafe, it's a comedy science fiction short in the experimental jokes shorts program, the shorts block here at the Adirondack Film Festival. Is this your first time at the festival?
No, this is my third time here.
Really?
Yeah, first time with a film in the festival. Although I was background in the movie Radium Girls that was here last year.
Yeah. My God, Radium Girls. That's awesome. That is. God, I had such a good time watching Radium Girls.
Yeah, it's great.
And I had to catch it later, because this is my first time at the festival. I've never actually been to New York before, but city or state.
Oh wow!
So this is a really interesting experience. And since you've been here the last couple of years, you've seen this festival kind of balloon quite a bit. There's mm-hmm. 300 filmmakers, you among them, here to screen their films. I mean, how does it feel to be in such a wide field of creatives?
It's amazing. I love it. And I love coming to this festival, even like when I didn't have a film in it. Just being in the environment, being around so many filmmakers is just absolutely inspiring. And also seeing, I know it's the tagline or whatever, seeing something new.
Yeah. it's one of those things, like, there's so much stuff I mean you're gonna see stuff as big as, I know Jojo Rabbit is closing out the film festival.
Yeah.
I'm so upset I have to fly back to Chicago before
screens.
Yeah, I was totally bummed, because it's not gonna play in Chicago for at least another couple weeks. We're always like at least a couple weeks behind LA and New York, so I was like, oh damn it. But now that you are a filmmaker that has a film here, are you, you know, not to get too deep into it, but are you a little nervous? Are you kind of scared of the reaction? Or are you just like, hey, I'm happy to be here?
I'm happy to be here. I've seen it with an audience once.
Mm-hmm.
Gemfest, which was here last year. They showed some films, and Old Hearts Cafe was one of them. And so I guess I was probably honestly more nervous then, just because it was the first time watching it with an audience. Of course, you're asking me now when it's not showtime yet. Maybe when it's showtime, I'll be nervous.
Get a little bit more butterflies.
Yeah. I do find it interesting to watch with an audience, though, because my first time watching it with an audience, I was seeing things that I could have definitely done better. Seeing changes I would have made that I would not have seen if I hadn't seen it with an audience.
Yeah.
Like, there's one scene that the movie's great, but there's one scene that I actually think is like the best scene of it. I don't want to say what it is, but I just wish I'd opened with that.
Okay.
Because I feel like it really sets the tone for the rest of the film. So sometimes people don't realize it's a comedy, and this scene is so funny that usually people laugh at it, and I wish I had opened with that, because then that would have set the tone and made the rest of the movie funnier.
Yeah. Do you have plans to change it around? Do you want to change it around, or are you just like, you know what? It's done.
No.
You're moving on.
It's done. I can't do the George Lucas thing and change stuff. Once it's done, it's done. I'm just going to learn for the next time.
Yeah. No, I mean, you could CGI a couple of different dinosaurs or like different creatures in there. Redo a CGI Yoda. But you know what? I think you've got the right idea. Once the art is fit, you're going to want to change everything every time you watch it. You'll be like, oh, you know what? Yeah. I don't love this shot anymore. Maybe I would have done it this way. It could drive you insane.
Nothing is ever done.
Yeah.
So you just gotta step away. Once it's been seen by people, that's when it's done for me.
All right. Ken Holmes, actor, director, behind Old Hearts Cafe, a comedy sci-fi short here at the Adirondack Film Festival. As much as I love this place, that is, I have had to practice for the last 2 weeks pronouncing the name Adirondack. it is beyond the Midwestern lexicon. Ken, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
So, failed track tape. I'm almost at a loss for words for what I experienced watching that in the shorts program. I've seen, obviously, your work before, Lane Marie, and it was very on brand, if that means something as a compliment, in terms of it was something that I expected visually, but not so much narratively. I feel like this was a really different place for you to go in certain ways. So tell me a little bit about how Veiled Tractate came together and what was the initial kernel of inspiration.
Well, Campbell O'Hare and I have worked together for many, many years because we went to college together. So honestly, I think that Veiled Tractate in a lot of ways is not quite a departure from the kind of work I make now. In fact, I think it's very similar to where I started. Mm. Voiceover, poetry, a lot of visuals that are more subjective, a protagonist that we follow throughout that's kind of voyeuristic. So I feel like it came to be really organically, and that Campbell O'Hare was visiting me from where she lives, Philadelphia, and she's a wonderful actress, does a lot of great work in Philadelphia, and I dreamed up some vignettes and characters and themes that I knew I wanted to explore with her, because we've always had plans to we're going to make a Southern Gothic horror movie. Like I'm basically like just leading the charge there eventually, but to get to there, other things have to be made along the way. And so this was kind of like in the interim, here's something that we can create together.
Okay. Putting that together. And so you feel that this is something that is somewhat of a return to an original form. These are ideas that you've already been playing with, and now you're synthesizing them into this short.
Well, I think when I first started making films, if somebody were to look back at the Stonebirds, Build Lily Splash, The Adventures of Miss Glitch, just some of those early pieces, the format is similar. Mm-hmm. Within which I mean that I use a lot of the same devices, like voiceover, poetry, even going as far as to using myself.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because you provided the voiceover for this, correct?
I did. I wouldn't have done that if Campbell lived in Chicago, right. But I think it worked out for the best. And I actually was considering having her somehow get a hold of a studio or something originally, and then I actually was thinking about letting her write it, and then I think the big thing about this process, and the crew can definitely speak to this too, is it was definitely an exercise in trusting myself, because I haven't made something so close to who I really am in a long time, and so since my early days. So that's why it doesn't feel so much like a departure, but really a return to me, I guess.
Okay. And Veiled Track Day was nestled in with this kind of, I don't know if experimental is the right word for the shorts program, because there were so many things that felt familiar and right about what I was watching with the other pieces as well. But would you describe this as an experimental film, as a perhaps non-narrative?
I would. I think that, you know, we worked really hard to provide a storyline, an arc, a place to follow. My experimental work, there's often still like a through line, because I feel like that's what gives us the chance as the audience to really see ourselves in it. But I would define it as an experimental film, just in that it riffs and goes away and comes back and leaves the audience ultimately to make decisions for themselves.
One of my impressions from the film was this sort of interest and focus on aesthetics, not just for the character herself. You know, there's scenes of her going through different wigs and modeling, in a sense, like, you know, enjoying her own sense of aesthetic, but also the world that she inhabits. It's incredibly colorful. It's incredibly diverse in the way that at points she's, you know, up with neon, these incredible lights, and then there's some just truly remarkable shots where she's looking into like a reflective surface, and there's layers of the reflection and of the mirroring. So how do you feel about this film aesthetically? Was that a particular choice, like, hey, I want this to look a very particular way and be focused on that aesthetic?
It was, especially 2018, 2019, on into 2020. I have been really honing in on aesthetic and exploring that very specifically. So the piece for the most part was all improvised, just in that like movement, and then along the way the narrative sort of like informed us like what it wanted to be. But I did a lot of scouting beforehand, so I just like went to Chinatown one day, went to a wig shop, just went to all the locations by myself, and like sort of did like a walkthrough as the director, like thinking about, okay, how would I want her to move? Do I want her to dance down the aisle? Probably. She could play with that wig. She could play with that wig. And then also like giving myself enough freedom, like while we were on location, like the fire wig that she wears, that to me is probably at this point I see as being perhaps the most iconic moment of the film, which I didn't until maybe yesterday. I randomly picked that wig, and today I actually realized that I think, to be totally vulnerable, I think I picked that wig because it reminded me of me. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of visceral and strange and cathartic and fun.
Part of that improvisational nature, just feel whatever feels right, and then in the end it kind of comes out feeling the best.
Yeah. And Campbell is such a chameleon. Like, we went to acting school together, and so I know what she's capable of, and I feel like she knows what I'm capable of too. And so it was just a really wonderful opportunity for us to stretch our director actor team muscles.
Very cool. Let's jump on over to the production side of things. Amy, you are the producer of Veiled Track Tape.
Yes.
And how did you get involved with the project? When did you and Lane Marie come together for this meeting of the minds and say, hey, let's make this thing?
And actually, I don't remember when it was. Do you remember?
It was sometime like after the film. I had like a rough cut of the film, and Kate was starting to do sound design, and I was realizing, because originally I was like, I'm going to do this whole thing by myself. I got like as far as like producing and directing, and then last June, and then I was like, actually, no, you need help. And so I did like a call on the internet looking for the right person, and Amy was the right person.
And I came along.
Yeah. So you came along with there was a rough cut already.
Yeah.
A decent amount of it had been shot, or at least
all of it had been shot. Sorry, I'm interrupting you.
No, that's okay. Please, you can talk over me. Please talk over me. It's okay.
All of it had been shot, but I think there was only like 5 minutes.
The beginning and the end.
It hadn't been shot? Yeah. Whoa, I didn't even know that. See, I'm learning even right now. Yeah, so a lot of it had been shot, and then I just started doing marketing for it. And then when they started getting more of a cut together, I was in meetings and, you know, just kind of encouraging Lane Marie to follow her own instincts. That was something that I tried to prioritize, because, like, this is a passion project group kind of collaboration film. So the producer role was not necessarily one that was usual, I guess.
Right.
So yeah, that became my first priority, of just trying to encourage Lane Marie to follow her own path in the film.
And it's interesting you talk about the producer role. I feel like that's an often misunderstood or just kind of obscured idea, because on a film, you know, it seems like a director, a cinematographer, all that kind of, an actor, very defined. People kind of know what that is and what people do. When it comes to producers, they can come along at various points during the film, whether it's, you know, at the very beginning, helping with the writing of scripts and the setting of locations, to a little bit later on, when the film needs to get a little bit more polished, a little bit more finished and ready for something like a festival run. So when you hopped on, what did you feel? You mentioned wanting to have Lane Marie follow her instincts. What were some of the other goals that you had seeing this rough cut, and where did you want it to go from there?
I definitely sensed a story somewhere in the film, and I really wanted to bring that out, because I wanted the audience to follow Hummer, the main character, Hummer's journey into this cliff dive, into what I think is kind of like, Kate used the word implosion earlier, an implosion of self, of there's so many selves, and how do we find which one is right? Do we know? Like, so I wanted to bring that story out, and I'm really big as I want the films that I work on to be well timed, to be succinct enough to give the audience just enough of what it needs to get a grasp of what's going on and move on. So I wanted it to have a good pace and clip along, so that we could really enjoy the ride and be taken on a ride with Hummer.
Mm-hmm. Does it ever get tiring having to think of a film at that sort of level? You know, you're not, while you are somewhat immersed in the creativity and the story and all that kind of stuff, the filmmaking process, as a producer, sometimes you have to be thinking of where the audience is and how you can shape things and pretend, put yourself in the audience's shoes. How is it going to feel timing wise? You mentioned, how is it going to feel story wise? Are they going to quote unquote get it? Is that tough at times when you want to also enjoy the film for what it is?
I think it's almost interchangeable for me. I enjoy it by being the audience, by putting myself in their position and finding the moments when, like, oh, well, here I'm tuning out a little bit. Why is that? Is this going on too long? Do we need to change up the editing? So I guess, no, it doesn't get tiring. I think that's a gift that I have, actually, of being able to take a step outside of the work and give it an honest, critical view, because I can see so much potential in it, and I want to, like, hone it and bring out the very best details to get the best result.
So I'm guessing there were at least a couple sessions where you and Lane Marie would sit down and you'd be like, all right, here's some notes. Here's how I feel about certain things. What was that process like, and how did it make your creative bond deeper, and how did it affect the film overall?
Well, Lane Marie was so gracious in that she really welcomed everyone's point of view. It from the very top felt like an open room for discourse and honesty, and we all were able to give her the notes, our honest thoughts of what was happening and what it was missing. And Lane Marie always heard them, and I think that group effort kind of made it easier. What was the question?
Well, I mean, when you have that kind of open environment, sometimes it can be a little bit hostile on a film set. I think sometimes there can be a little bit of like, oh, how dare you tell me what to do? Mm-hmm, you know, this is my project. But it's it's a necessary thing. It's very important to have the discussions because you need that outside perspective. And before you get to the festival circuit with a short like this, you're not necessarily going to have traditional test screenings that like a big budget picture might have. So y'all are the test screenings. You are the ones saying, hey, this is where the audience might be at, and you have to have that best guess. So it seems to me like there was little tension and mostly collaboration. That was the main goal.
Absolutely. I think it matters that everybody was bringing in positive attitudes, and mine specifically was that's why I'm trying to really bring out what Lane Marie wants, because I'm on her side and I'm making her film, not mine. So I can give her my notes as like, listen, these are my concerns, and if she justifies them and she's like, oh well, I did that on purpose because of X, then I'm like, cool, great, you got it, heard, and let's move on.
It's so nice to hear this because a lot of the narratives around filmmaking are, oh my God, I had to talk to the editor and they're giving me this amount of shit, and I had to talk to sound and they're giving me this amount of shit, and we're arguing over things and things are not happening at a pace that we want them to. It's really nice to know that a short film can get made in a very positive environment, very very loving environment. Anna, if you want to take the mic here, tell me a little bit about, at what point did you come on the project, and a little bit about your background as well.
Sure. So Lane Marie approached me after the first round of footage had been shot. So most of the film, like the character vignettes, had been shot. And there was no script. She just sort of brought me this footage and we sat down together and looked through the footage, and she's like, I want to make a film out of this. Like, and just looking at the footage, I felt like I understood the story that she was trying to tell. And I think at first neither of us really had necessarily the words to describe the story in it, but like we could feel it was there. So it was sort of this process of like excavating the story out of the footage. So we like kind of brainstormed a lot of different ideas about like what format that would take, and did a couple like different versions of the edit. But I think we honed in on sort of this like, you know, chaptered vignette format pretty early on. And it was just such a fun collaborative process. Like, I'm so used to being handed like a script and some footage, and like you cut the script, and there's not a lot of, you know, room for like improvisation and like really working outside the box and trying new things. Like, you have to work within the constraints of, you know, the script that's been given to you. But, you know, it was really a privilege to be a part of kind of the narrative creation process. You know, it felt like being part of pre-production as a post-production individual. So that was new and exciting for me.
Yeah, that is a rare opportunity, because like you said, you get handed the script, this is where we want the story to go, and while there might be variations in that, things might get moved around, you're still working with something fairly concrete. So when it comes to bringing out the narrative of this short, what did you see in it as an editor? What did you, looking at this footage, this improvised sort of thing, what were you getting out of it?
Definitely this whole theme of identity was immediately apparent to me. You know, each location that was chosen, it felt like she was playing a very specific character in each of those locations. And just watching through the footage, it almost felt kind of like a visual diary entry to me, of Hummer's character, and that she was like trying on these different identities to see like what fit. And so that's sort of where we started, is like, okay, how can we play with this theme of identity, and like, how do we craft this into a narrative without words? You know, how do we like express this as sort of this like cinematic poem almost? So it kind of snowballed from there. Like, again, it really felt like this excavation process. We'd go through an edit and things would come out of it where, you know, I don't think I was even consciously thinking of certain things, and then we'd watch it and like the film, I felt, spoke to us at certain points where we're like, oh, like this feels really like present, like this theme or this idea, like I love that feels right, like let's keep moving with that idea. And that happened multiple times throughout the process. So it was really cool to like watch the film almost make itself in a way. And I was like, we were just all partners in discovering what it was always meant to be.
Was it tough to leave some stuff on the cutting room floor? Because obviously every frame of this oozes a bunch of beauty and a lot of interesting stuff that I'm guessing the raw footage alone, you could probably be like, you know what, we're going to just slap this out there. We'll see what people think of it. They can make whatever they want. But obviously you want to give it some shape. You want to give it a pace, beats, chapters, all this sort of stuff. So when it came to leaving certain things out that didn't necessarily fit that excavation, was it tough? And do you miss some of the footage?
Not really, actually. I think one of my traits as an editor, I'm a pretty ruthless editor, I think. Like, I have no problem cutting my darlings. So, like, I can recognize when, like, this shot's beautiful, but it's gotta go. Like, it's not working. So, I don't know. I think, for me, just getting to see it, I'm like, that was pretty. I enjoyed watching that. But, yeah, I'm a little ruthless when it comes to the edit. Like, I like to chop things, because I like things to be, like, snappy and to, like, get to the point and... You know, yeah, that's...
Yeah. I wanted to say, is that the mark of a good editor? Because you get so many... get a lot of films in general that might take way too many liberties and just be like, oh, we're going to just hold on this for a really long time. Nothing wrong with slow cinema, but at the same time, there are moments you know that something is not working when you're sitting in a film and you're like, wow, can we move on to the next thing maybe? So you like to take a little bit more of like, yeah, let's get down and dirty. Let's make this happen. Let's get the film going.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think there's always a time and place. Like, it depends on what you're going for. There's certainly an occasion to have slower pace. And because I like things to be quick and snappy, like, I think that's one of the things I have to, you know, work on when, you know, it is meant to be a slower paced film. Like, I have to remind myself, okay, like, it's okay to sit in this moment. But that being said, I think more often than not, you do want to be a little more like ruthless in the edit and cut things out, which I think is an advantage to like be able to get in there. But again, like, that is certainly a skill to recognize when it is good to sit in a moment. And I have to like remind myself to do that at times too, since my gut is to, you know, to cut.
So it's rare that I get to actually talk to someone whose main focus is editing. You know, a lot of the times, especially in Chicago, folks are doing multiple roles. They're editing their own, they're shooting, editing, and doing everything about their own film. So when it comes to editors in general, I haven't really gotten to ask how much of an editor's thumbprint makes it onto a film, in your opinion. Obviously, a director is out shooting the film and bringing the raw footage to you, but when it gets to the editing room, how much of a film is really made by an editor?
It really depends on the team you're working with, because sometimes the director is very like, you know, you're going to cut here, and then, you know, 5 seconds later, we're going to cut to this shot, and they're like very, you know, they have their hands right in it saying like, this is what I want, and you don't have as much room to really add your own, you know, creative voice to it. But one of the things I really love about working with Lane Marie is she gives me so much creative freedom to really add my own voice into it. So I'd say it really varies on the project. And that's one of the things that I look for when I collaborate, you know, with other filmmakers, is I really like to work with directors that allow me to have that freedom, because otherwise I'm just a button pusher. Sure. You know, at a certain point. So like, I've worked on films where there was none of my voice in it because it got stifled out. Which is like really unfortunate when that happens, but you know, it certainly does happen. So yeah, it's one of the things that I'm discriminating about in terms of who I work with.
I think that's a good thing to have, because editors can really get the short end of the stick.
For sure.
And I would hate to have someone who spends so much time learning a craft and having to know so much about editing footage and having a wide idea of what cinema can look like and what it can be being reduced to, I'm just gonna drag this here and then this is that scene and blah blah. So that's, I'm glad that that was part of the process for you. Let's jump on over to Kate, because this is a film with incredible sound design. That was one of the things that I was absolutely blown away. I was having a full experience. I'm very, as you can tell, I'm very sound oriented. As much as I love images and I love stories, sound is really important to me in movies.
And you both.
Yeah, it was spectacular. So when you got involved with this, what was your vision sonically? Did you and Lane lay something out like, hey, this is where we want to go with the sound, or was it carte blanche?
So I should probably talk a little bit about how Lane Marie and I first met and started working together. Was basically, so I first met her, we say it was 2 years ago. I thought it was a year. Okay, 2 years ago, she says. I first met her at the Women of the Now Film Festival. Never met her before. I'd creeped her a bit on her Vimeo account, looked at her work, checked it out. As soon as I met her and I saw some of her work, I targeted her. I said, I'm whatever it takes, we're working together. Gonna make it happen. And I didn't stop pestering her until it did. Then what happened is I sort of reimagined Bill the Lily Splash, which was one of her earliest works. And I did what I do, which is I got as weird with it as I'm allowed to. I'm really, really drawn to disorientation and absurdism, discomfort in any way. You know, I like to return to the weird as opposed to trying to find it or elevate into that. Like, go back and find what is absurd, you know. And Lane Marie's work really allows for that, and I was so very attracted to it for that reason. So we had worked together with Bill the Lily Splash, and she loved what I did, and she trusted my vision very much. So when she approached me about Veil Tractate, it was as open-ended as all of us have described it. It was, you know, this friend of mine, this incredible actress and dancer, and I got together, and we just shot some stuff, and I don't know what to make of it. I think I've got a rough idea, and she did. She had an outline. She had some poems that she had written, and I was sent some stills. I fell in love with the stills immediately, and I loved the words that she wrote. There was no sound in the film. She did have a playlist that she had made, and some temp music had been placed in by Anna, but that was disregarded fast because I didn't even really listen to that very much because I knew we needed to start from scratch. How it started was Lane Marie came over and I just mic'd her up, and she just read all the poems. I had her whisper some, you know, moan some, sing some, read some, you know, upside down, any which way, you know, and got as many different sounds and perspectives of the words as possible, and then took all those sound files and I just cut them up and played with them. And then was the process of this. So I will say this, and I don't know if this is like, we're not allowed to say this, but for me, discovering what the film needed to sound like was needing to discover and learn Lane Marie's psyche better. It was so very much, the more I found Lane Marie in the film, the better I was able to carve her out in the film, the closer I got to hitting the marks in the film, you know? So, it was really a process of, and I do this with most directors that I work with, which is that, like, in order for me to really know and love their film, I need to know them intimately, because you can't remove the filmmaker from the film, and a filmmaker can try to remove themselves and speak of the character, and it's not me at all, but they're always there somewhere. And since you were speaking to aesthetics so much, it was very much about that. I needed to find Lane Marie's sound as opposed to finding the film sound. And once I shifted my perspective in that way, that I wasn't trying to, like, because I was there for a while. I was really like analyzing the film, getting a little like academic, feminist about it, and I think I was projecting some ideas. Maybe I was trying too hard to make it logical, and then I realized, no, I need to find Lane Marie inside of it. Before we left yesterday, it's the hours have blended together. Yeah. Lane Marie and I were hanging outside a coffee shop waiting for Amy and Anna to show up, and she was telling me about this very bizarre dream she had. My immediate response was just like, well, all right, let's break this down. Let's analyze this. And it occurred to me later that day that like, this film was very much like a good friend of yours has this very bizarre dream, means something, and you can sense that it really means something, and you've got to find this, you've got to find the symbolism. And so it was all of us kind of helping her, and her, even indeed Lane Marie, trying to understand what this dream of hers meant. She knew it was something. Sometimes when it's so personal, it's too close to see it yourself. You know what I mean? It was maybe too close at first for Lane Marie to see what it meant to her. And so it was all of us kind of coming together and analyzing this very strange dream that we knew was deeply important to Lane Marie. And I think we all came to love and appreciate each other very much in sharing that vision and like Anna said, excavating it, you know? Yeah, that was a very, I don't know, I meandered quite a bit there.
That is okay. That is very okay. I'm going to chew on that for a second. All of that through sound. I really love that. I really love the idea of having to get to know someone really well, and that
of course,
a way to get to that is through the sound. This is a film that's very focused on, obviously, a dance performance and just body performance, that sort of thing. And I'm not a person that, I don't claim to understand a lot of modern dance. I'm just like, yeah, that looks really hard and difficult, and it's very beautiful, but I don't get it. But I think this particular piece reached me on a certain level because of all the sound that was going on and the synergy of that. And I don't know if it was, I'm guessing it was partly because of your mental excavation of Lane and this mental merging, or just when you went in with the music as well, and you got to see the actual movements of the character, and you got to see how she interacted with the world. What was your approach to meeting that and getting into that headspace?
So I have to say, I was a dancer for many years. So, I mean, that spoke to me, the movement. But that aside, I maybe did 4 or 5 passes, 3 of them just for fun, because Campbell, I think, became my muse in many ways. The way that she moves, I could score her every which way. Like, I wanted to.
You want to make like 4 films out of this.
Exactly. Like, her movement inspired me so very much that that was nothing. I could have scored. That was easy. In fact, I had a rough score before we even had our first, before the rough cut was even done. Like, I was like, here, like days later, I kept saying like, I just want to, can I just like do this movie 3 or 4 times so I can, because there was so much to unearth there, but I couldn't, that wasn't enough because it wasn't just Hummer, it was Lane Marie, you know, I mean, that was the surface. We needed to dig deeper than that before we were really able before I could really hear it. I need to intimately know someone, and when I know how someone sounds, which is how I think of people when I meet people, I think of their soundtrack immediately in my head. Like, this is what you sound like. And that's what I needed to do for Lane Marie. It couldn't just be for Hummer. It couldn't be for Campbell's movements. It couldn't be for the shots, for the color. Although Anna and me inspired each other enormously. Our workflow was really interesting in that, like, normally workflow works. I mean, you move down the line. You know, I rarely, if ever, meet or talk to the editor and colorist. But there were, like, I had done a final pass, and then we went back and did some more editing. And so Anna and I, like, spent a night together really exploring each other's visions. I never really know what an editor's vision is. They don't tell me, and I don't tell that. That rarely happens. And it was so rewarding for it to happen that way in this film. So we inspired each other a lot. Just in general, like, the way the workflow, the way that we all collaborated was unique, possibly a once-in-a-lifetime chance. So bonding. I wouldn't trade the experience for the world. It was a lot of time. It was a lot of work. It genuinely was a labor of love. We can say that with so much sincerity.
Yeah. I mean, the intimacy of everyone's work really comes through at the end of the day. I felt, you know, when it's playing with other shorts, it's hard not to compare because it's happening one after another. You're just kind of seeing a bunch of things, and as at the end of this festival, there's going to be voting and things like that, so you've got that running a little bit in the back of your head. But I will say, this was the short that made me feel most involved as a viewer. I was like, I really was sitting there like, oh, okay, I felt part of this. I felt like I was really in the world that was being displayed on screen. And I don't mean to use that as a criticism against the other filmmakers, because they were great in their own ways. But this one, I was very much entranced. Lane Marie, you mentioned voyeurism. There was a certain level where it was like, wow, I feel odd that I am watching this very clearly intimate thing happening on screen. And it was really an experience in that regard. Now, this was all shot in Chicago. Lane Marie, you and I have talked about Chicago how many times now? I mean, every time we see each other, we're talking about how Chicago works. But you're a filmmaker of many different places in this world. Why did you want to shoot this one in Chicago, other than, you know, you're living in Chicago?
Well, I think, I mean, the Chinatown in Chicago is very inspiring. So I feel like it was all the neon lights. I mean, I feel like I had passed through Chinatown, but I hadn't. Actually, our DP, when he and I were in our early, Alex Halstead, when we were in the early stages talking about this film, because I knew I was going to do this, and I mentioned it to him, and he was like, oh, I'd really like to shoot that. And I was like, okay, sure. And we started talking about, like, potential environments that we were both interested in, and Chinatown was one of them. And so that was, like, when I went and scouted, and I saw the neon phone just sold me. I was like, all right, she has to dial this. She has to have a fake phone call. That's going to happen. You know, like, I took pictures of everything that I intended to plant her alongside. And so I feel like the thing that makes it a Chicago film is, besides the location, I mean, I feel like the people involved, whether they're from Chicago or not, we all feel like the spirit of community and collaboration. And I feel like that's the main reason why that was, like, the lifeblood of this project, because Chicago really has that. I mean, that's why I'm about to live in Chicago for my fifth year, even though I was thinking about leaving.
What? yeah. Unacceptable. No, I understand.
The warmth, you know. I'm a little photosynthesis person, so I need the sun.
Yeah,
but
Chicago's not a good place for that.
No. So we'll have to figure that out eventually. But I mean, I didn't really know a lot of people when I first came to Chicago, and then just by circumstance and connection, and I met the women that are sitting around me now, you know, like, it's all been such a journey.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a certain quality to, I think, any film either made in the Midwest or made in Chicago. Even though this is a very aesthetically bright and colorful and just so engaging. It seems like something that someone might look at it and say, like, oh, this is clearly made in LA. But I really don't think so.
Yeah. Good, I like that too.
But they're,
I like the LA aesthetic. I'm here for it.
But there's just something to it, and maybe it's because of my own prior knowledge. I'm like, yeah, this is made by a bunch of people from Chicago. This is Chicago,
yeah.
Indie. This is like, there's something just it's the city of broad shoulders, the city of hard work, and just there was just something like, yeah, we're gonna just go do this. And mm-hmm. it took a lot of elbow grease and all that kind of stuff, and that came to me. But maybe again, that was bringing my own reading to it.
Yeah, no, I think that's super accurate. I think there's certainly grit to it, and grit is a word that I've identified with for a long time, and that partially might be because I'm Southern and lived in Philadelphia, and now I'm in Chicago, and in order to survive in any of those places, there's a certain level of like sincerity and like grit that like you have to have.
You got
to
have the unfuckwittability.
Yeah. But still be nice.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the weird part. I mean, and if anybody would like to speak to, I know this will probably get off topic from the film here, but the Midwest nice, very interesting, and I grew up in it, and I don't really get it. You have to be on, like, say you get on the L, you know, if someone bumps into you, you go, oh yeah, no, sorry, no, it's no big deal. But like, if you're just sitting there, you kind of got to mean mug people a little bit, just like, don't fucking talk to me, that sort of thing. But you know, being in the Midwest, and we're just gonna go open mic here if anybody wants to grab it, being in the Midwest, how has that affected your careers and your artistry? What does that do for you being in a place like Chicago?
I have an answer.
Yeah, go. So I can say, coming from the East Coast, I was blown away on arrival here, just how welcoming every art community is. I came just purely working in music when I first came to Chicago, and was almost suspicious of how welcoming the art community was, and when I came to work in the film industry, it was no different. You know, I think that there's an enormous amount of trust in the Midwest, in other people's visions and work and efforts, that there certainly is not in either the East or the West Coast. And so there's room for artists to breathe and fail, and that means a lot. To be able to, you learn so much more from your failures than you do your successes. There's no room for failure in New York or the West Coast. You know, so that leaves for so much growth, and that makes for so much solidarity in the scene, because we know that we're all there for each other's failures and successes. And the expectations are different. You know, I still haven't found a way to describe what expectations mean artistically in Chicago. We show up for each other in a way that I haven't experienced in any other place in the country. Yeah,
I think that's incredibly accurate. I think with the expectations, just from what I've seen, the expectation is just that, is that you're going to go, and when someone does something, whether you don't have to like laud it, you don't have to tell them it's great, the greatest thing they've ever done, you don't have to just constantly pat them on the back, but you have to go, and you have to show them that you care so that they'll keep going. I can't imagine what it's like in New York or LA when it comes to the art scenes, because they're so, you know, blown up. Everything matters. Everything has to be your absolute best. Otherwise, you get buried, you get blackballed by the community, and then all of a sudden, you're totally out on your ass. So, I think the Midwest is a great place to be. And the Midwest is, to me, what makes films like this possible. You get people who will just... You're just going to come together. Like, I still can't get over the amount of love that clearly was happening during this process. It's really remarkable. It's true. It is. It's true. Like, It's rare that you get to hear these stories. Yeah. a sickening amount of love and care. Really, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk with you all. Thank you so much for inviting me here. And again, I loved it. I thought it was great. If it's not going to get me in trouble, it's going to get my vote for something. Whatever it's up for being voted for, it's going to get some votes, because it was great. Not a bad first day of the Adirondack Film Festival, if I do say so myself. So I think we'll cap it off there. Thank you again. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.